I'd like to read some verses from the Rodwell translation. It was completed in 1861. Okay, that's 1861. See if you can tell which book this comes from, because it is going to sound different for you. The angel said, O Mary, verily God announceth to thee the word from him. His name shall be Messiah Jesus, the son of Mary, illustrious in this world and in the next, and one of those who have near access to God. And he shall speak to men alike when in the cradle and when grown up, and he shall be one of the just. She said, How, O my Lord, shall I have a son when man hath not touched me? He said, Thus God will create what he will. When he decreeth a thing, he only saith be, and it is. It's different from what we're used to, isn't it? Now, usually when I ask people to guess what book, they'll usually say Matthew or Luke. But actually, I read from the Quran, the holy book of Islam. Sneaky of me, wasn't it? But I was surprised when I first read that passage, as probably most people are when they hear that. And it's interesting that the Quran does recognize Jesus as a prophet. It recognizes the virgin birth of Jesus. In fact, Jesus plays a prominent part in their end time prophecies. The Quran talks about Jesus coming out of paradise to lead the Muslim armies against the armies of the Antichrist. And he'll be victorious, and according to Quran, he'll convert the whole world to Islam. But why did I read from the Quran? Am I going to give you new truth that's been revealed only to me? No, no new truth. Please rest assured on that. So why did I read from the Quran? Well, once again, radical Islam is in the news with the killings in Paris and, of course, then the killings in San Bernardino, California. And, of course, radical Islamists became very real to all of us in the United States after the events of 9/11. And now we have ISIS taking over parts of Syria and Iraq as they kill and commit atrocities, and they do it in the name of Islam. And ISIS has replaced Al-Qaeda as the number one terrorist group in the world. But Al-Qaeda is still out there, and they are ready to kill in the name of Islam, as is the Taliban. And then let's not forget the continuing conflict between Palestinians and Israelis, between Muslims and Jews. Then there's the fight for Jerusalem, the fight for Israel / Palestine. And then there is the hatred that Muslim extremists have for America. And that hatred is increasing. And all that we just mentioned continues, and it's only going to get worse. And because of all this, many people, talking about people in the United States, have wanted to know more about Islam and the people who practice it, especially those people in the Middle East. Now, I imagine that the sales of the Quran have increased dramatically in the last decade or so because more people want to know exactly what does the Quran say. I did, and I got a Quran. But the good news is that more people are still buying the Holy Bible because more people who do profess a belief in the Bible want to know what it says, and because they have questions. And hopefully they'll get answers if they do read those new Bibles that they bought. And one question that many Americans want to know is, why do these terrorists hate us so? Many people also want to know why we're involved in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and why we're allied with Israel and not the Palestinians. And perhaps the biggest question that people in our country want an answer to is, when will all this end? Once the wars in Syria and Iraq are over, once ISIS is destroyed, once Al-Qaeda is eliminated, many people will think that it has ended. And they'll want to go back to those comfortable lives that they enjoyed before Islamic terrorism was brought home to all of us. In fact, people will insist on it. But this war on terrorism won't end when ISIS and Al-Qaeda are destroyed, if they will be. It won't end when the wars in Syria and Iraq are over, if they will be. It won't end if Israel and Palestine agree to exist as two separate states. So, when will it end? Well, the answer is not found in this book, the Quran. Instead, the answer is found in this book, the Holy Bible. And today we are going to look to this book, the Bible, to see when it will end, and also when it all began. And we'll see that this war on terrorism won't end until after the return of Jesus Christ. The hatred between Arabs and Jews is not going to end without the direct involvement of this same Jesus. And Muslim extremists will not stop hating until they learn God's way of life that will be taught to the whole world after Jesus Christ returns. Now, most Arabs are Muslims. So as we look at the animosity between Arabs and Jews, we'll also look at the major religion of the Arab world, Islam. And we'll see what role it plays in the seemingly never-ending conflict between Arabs and Jews. But first, why do Arabs and Jews have all this hatred for one another? Some say it's just a fight over land. Many think it's just another religious conflict, one of many around the world. So is this conflict between Arab and Jew any different? I think we all know that, yes, it is different. And this conflict started out in a way that most people today do not understand and cannot understand. If only the Palestinian-Israeli conflict was as simple as being about two religions fighting with one another, or as simple as only about a fight over land, but it's not. It goes much deeper than that. Brethren, let's go to the book of Genesis, a book of beginnings, including the beginning of a conflict that takes center stage in the world today. Let's go back and read about Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael. And we'll also take a look at the Muslims and the Quran, what they say about Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael. Because remember, most Arabs are Muslims, and Arabs look to Abraham as their father, the father of many nations. Let's pick it up in Genesis 17, verse 1. Genesis 17, verse 1. And we're very familiar with this story. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am Almighty God, walk before me and be blameless, and I will make my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly. Then Abram fell on his face and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you and you shall be a father of many nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you in their generations, for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your descendants after you. And I also give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. Drop down to verse 15. Then God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name, and I will bless her, and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of many nations. Kings of people shall be from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old, and shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael may live before you. Then God said, no, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant and with his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this time set time next year. So the covenant with Abraham was to continue through his son, but not Ishmael, his son by Hagar, Sarah's servant, but through his son Isaac by his wife Sarah. Now let me read the Islamic belief regarding Abraham. And to help me understand better what Islam teaches, I bought this book called Understanding Islam. It's written by Yahya Emmerich. The complete name is The Complete Idiot's Guide to Understanding Islam. Many of you are familiar with Books for Dummies. Well, this is basically the same type of thing. It simplifies any subject that they write about. And it did simplify what Islam teaches. So let me read what Understanding Islam teaches about Abraham. And we'll pick up this story in midstream. Now, as he rested with Hagar and their son, Abraham's great test was about to occur. The aged patriarch saw in a dream that he was sacrificing his son on an altar. When Abraham told his son about this, the boy courageously replied, "Do as you have been commanded." Abraham took the boy into the wilderness and tied him to a stone outcropping. Imagine the stress and anxiety felt by both. Abraham was being asked to take the life of his own beloved son, and the boy was lying there, knowing that his own father was about to kill him. But just as Abraham was about to strike with the knife, an angel came to him and told him to stop, because he had already demonstrated his willingness to give up everything he loved for God's sake. Both father and son rejoiced and found a ram nearby to sacrifice instead. Now, reading this account, you may have noticed that the boy who is going to be sacrificed is not Isaac, but Ishmael, which is the opposite from the biblical account of this story. Islam asserts that this story took place in the Valley of Baca, and that because God spared Ishmael and tested Abraham's faith, a great shrine would be built by the pair in celebration. This would be the forerunner of the present-day Kaaba. As the years passed, Ishmael was blessed with prophethood, and he gave the message of surrendering to God's will to the nomads of the desert. He continued the tradition established by his father of bringing servants to God to the shrine for pilgrimage. Eventually, people began settling in the Valley of Baca, and the name was later changed to Mecca. The Quran itself notes both the ancient name Baca and the modern name Mecca. And to this day, Muslims make pilgrimage to Mecca. They're supposed to, if able, to make one in their lifetime, one pilgrimage. And Mecca today is in Saudi Arabia. Some of you may remember, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years ago, over 2,000 pilgrims, many of them Iranian Muslim pilgrims, were crushed to death in the pilgrimage as they were trying to go around the shrine. And there's still some animosity over that between Iran and Saudi Arabia, among other things. Let me continue. After many more centuries had passed, Mecca became a vibrant town. But Abraham's religion was not to survive there intact. Gradually, people began to develop false ideas about spirits and a plurality of gods. It would be many years before God would send the right prophet to clean up those false ideas and restore the Kaaba, which is a shrine, to the worship of the one true God. That prophet, who would be a descendant of the prophet Abraham through his son Ishmael, was named Muhammad. Now, some people read accounts like that from the Bible and what the Quran says and think, well, that means Jews, Christians, and Muslims all look to Abraham as their father. So that means all three religions are related. And then they would ask, why the animosity among them? And that is a good question. And we'll find the answer in the Bible. Let's go to Genesis 16, verse 11. Let's see the prophecies concerning Ishmael. Genesis 16, we'll pick it up in verse 11. And the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He shall be a wild man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. The New Revised Standard Version says, and he shall live at odds with all his kin. The Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary states about this, he will be a wild man, literally a wild donkey man, expressing how the wildness of Ishmael and his descendants resembled that of a wild donkey. And about the scripture on his hand shall be against everyone, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown states, it's descriptive of the rude, turbulent, and plundering character of the Arabs. Now let's take a look at some of Ishmael's relatives. As we know, Ishmael and Isaac were brothers. Abraham was their father. And of course, Jacob was Isaac's son. So Ishmael was Jacob's uncle. And Jacob and Ishmael's sons were first cousins. And Jacob, or Israel's 12 sons, were first cousins once removed to Ishmael's sons. Still with me? Well, just remember, they're all kin to one another. Now, we know that Israel had 12 sons, but Ishmael also had 12 sons. We won't read it, but you can go to Genesis 25, verses 12 through 16, names all 12 of Ishmael's sons. In fact, the prophecy said that the 12 princes will come from Ishmael. Now, many of the Arab peoples look, or are descendants of Abraham, through Ishmael, and of course his 12 sons. And you know, if you look at their history, that you'll see that the various Arab tribes and then nation states never really got along with one another. And they still really don't. And as we look more closely at how Arab countries have supported the Palestinians through the years, we'll see that publicly, yes, they do support the Palestinians. With their words, they support them. But behind the scene, they've done really very little to help them. You know, all those oil-rich Arab countries, even before the price of oil dropped, think back how much money have they given to help the Palestinians in their poverty-stricken existence, because many do live in poverty in the Gaza Strip and West Bank. I think if you take a close look, we'd see that the Arab countries, especially those oil countries, could have been helping the Palestinians much more materially than what they have done down through the years. They could have done so much more to help their fellow Arabs and Muslims. So the descendants of Ishmael were prophesied not to get along with their own family, including Isaac and his descendants. And today the world doesn't realize that Arabs and Jews, Arabs and Israel, are family who can't get along. It's all a family feud. And the family feud started actually with Sarah and Ishmael. Then Ishmael and Isaac, brother against brother, then cousins against cousins. And it continues to this very day. Now, does Islam add fuel to the fire in the Middle East? Does it help keep the family feud going? Well, let's read again what the author of Understanding Islam has to say. He writes, it is not an article of faith for Muslims to destroy Israel. If the issue of Jerusalem could be solved to the satisfaction of the world's Muslims and the injustices done against the Palestinians resolved, then perhaps the modern state of Israel could exist in peace in the Middle East. And he adds in parentheses, Muslim rulers during the Crusades often made peace treaties with the Europeans. As of this writing, two Arab countries, which of course are Egypt and Jordan, have already concluded treaties with the Jewish-dominated state of Israel. More might be willing to do the same if the Israelis would concede that the wrongs were done and that Jerusalem should be the property of all the religions that claim it, or the property of none at all. Stay tuned. So in his view, religion in relation to Jerusalem is a main factor in the conflict in the Middle East. And I can think we can see that it does add to it. And as he said, stay tuned. Or as we like to say, watch and be ready. Now sometimes, when we're home on a Sunday morning, sometimes I'll catch some of the Sunday morning preachers as I flip through my remote to see what's on. And one time I remember one well-known preacher was talking about Islam. So I stopped and listened for a while. And he was talking about Islam, and he was not saying nice things about it. In fact, he said that the Quran tells Muslims to kill Christians and Jews. He made that very clear. I'm sure many of you have heard that before, that the Quran says to kill Christians and Jews. I have an article here by Dave Hunt. Some of you may know him as the author of A Woman Rides the Beast. Some of you have that book. I have it, and maybe you've heard of it. Well, he wrote an article entitled A Moment for Truth. I'd like to read some statements that Mr. Hunt made about Islam from this article. And here he's talking about September 11th. He writes, "What cause could so powerfully motivate educated and trained individuals to sacrifice their own lives and the lives of so many total strangers in this manner? In the minds of civilized people, these men were unbelievable fanatics. But were they? Could one call the spiritual leader of an entire major country a fanatic, a man universally recognized as properly representing his religion? Who would know his religion better than the spiritual leader himself? Such was Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini when he declared, 'The purest joy in Islam is to kill and be killed for Allah.' Is that fanaticism?" asked Mr. Hunt. He says this, "We have arrived at a defining moment when truth could triumph if the world would recognize that terrorists are not fanatics, but devout fundamentalist Muslims who are earnestly following their religion." Now, after reading that article, hearing that preacher on TV saying that the Quran says that Muslims should kill all Christians and Jews, of course, remembering the horrid events of 9/11 and then now the killings in Paris and San Bernardino, California, I want to know, what exactly does Islam teach? What does the Quran say, especially in relation to Christians and Jews? Does the Quran say what these men and others say it does? So that's why I got a copy of the Quran, in English, of course, and a book on understanding Islam to try to get to the facts. And the book, Understanding Islam, is, of course, pro-Islam, but I wanted something pro-Islam to balance things out. Again, let me read from Understanding Islam. He writes, "Given that Islam recognizes that Jews and Christians received authentic prophets and revelations in the past, the Quran uses a special title to separate them from mere idolaters. The term is al-kitab, or people of the book." And it does say that. "It is an allusion to the fact that Jews and Christians received holy books from God long before and can be counted on to have certain ideas and concepts that are similar to Islam's. The people of the book have such an elevated status that according to Islamic law, a Muslim man is allowed to marry a practicing Jewish or Christian woman, and he is not allowed to force her to convert or curtail her religious freedom. Some of the older people remember Yasser Arafat, who was over the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Of course, he was a Muslim Palestinian, but he married a Christian Palestinian. Most people don't remember that. And she was allowed, of course, to practice her faith. Then here in Understanding Islam, the author goes on to tell about the problems that Muhammad had with the Jews. Let me read a bit of that. The Quranic revelations received by Muhammad painted a picture of Judaism as it was then practiced that was extremely unflattering. The Quran accused the Jews of practicing racial discrimination and hypocrisy. It said that they were not following the teachings of Moses, and Islam does recognize Moses as a prophet too, and that their customs had no authority from God. But the worst of it, from the Jewish point of view, was still to come. When Muhammad first arrived in Medina, the Jews had been hopeful that he would denounce Jesus as an impostor. Judaism holds that Jesus is a false rabbi. But instead of rejecting Jesus, the Quran called him the Jewish Messiah and a messenger from God who was sent to call the wayward Jews back to true faith. Such a view was totally unacceptable to the Jews, and the situation deteriorated from there. If you're like me, I found that very interesting, that that's what the Quran teaches. So the author, at least of this book, claims it was the misuse of Judaism that the Quran is against, not Judaism in itself. Now let's look at some verses from the Quran, particularly those that some people say that Muslims should kill all Christians and Jews. Let me read from, again, Understanding Islam, because he also quotes in the Quran, and he quotes it accurately, at least the copy that I have. He quotes the Quran here, and you'll hear the Quran, it'll say, like, this is from Quran 2, chapter 2, verse 62, or you may hear it say Surah 2, verse 62. They're both the same. Rest assured that, this is from the Quran, Muslims, Jews, Christians, and Sabians, whoever believes in God and the last day and performs good deeds will be rewarded by their Lord. They will have nothing to fear or regret. So that's a positive message about Jews and Christians from the Quran. And like, as I said, he quotes it accurately. Now here he quotes the Quran chapter 4, verse 46, but he just gives a synopsis of it, and then we're going to read what it actually says. Quran 4, verse 47, I'm sorry. It says, many Jews do not keep God's laws about the Sabbath, kosher, and other things. And I don't think any of us would complain about that, would we? Say, well, that's not true. Yes, it is true. Well, let me read the Quran and what it says about that. Among the Jews are those who displace the words of their scriptures and say, we have heard and we have not obeyed. Hear thou, but as one that heareth not, and look at us, perplexing with their tongues and wounding the faith by their revilings. But if they would say, we have heard and we obey, hear thou and regard us, it were better for them and more right. But God has cursed them for their unbelief. Few only of them are believers. Now that's speaking against the Jews. Now, I found in reading this book on Understanding Islam that the author, and I did read practically the whole book, the author makes statements about what Islam is and what it isn't, but doesn't always quote from the Quran to support what he's saying. But of course, there are Christian writers who I think we know do the same thing about Christianity, make statements about what Christianity is and isn't, but don't always quote the Bible to support what they say. But the comments that stand out in my mind about the Quran are those comments that people say the Quran says the Muslims are to kill all Christians and Jews. I think you can see why they stand out to me. Again, let me read from Dave Hunt's article, Moment of Truth. He writes, "There are more than 100 verses in the Quran advocating the use of violence to spread Islam. In the Quran, Allah commands Muslims." And then he quotes parts of the Quran, and then he gives what book and chapter, and we'll look at those. "Take not the Jews and Christians as friends. Slay the idolaters," in parentheses, he says, "non-Muslims, wherever ye find them. Fight against such as believe not in Allah. Though most Muslims would shrink from obeying such commands, this is official Islam, and it cannot change without admitting that Muhammad was a false prophet and murderer." So that's what he says about the Quran. So I wanted to see what the Quran says that he was partially quoting. This is from the Quran. This is part of take not the Jews as friends. It says, "O believers, take not the Jews or Christians as friends. They are but one another's friends. If any one of you taketh them for his friends, he surely is one of them. God will not guide the evildoers." So that's not a very flattering comment about Jews and Christians in the Quran, is it? His second verse, well, part of it was, "Slay the idolater." So I went to the Quran to pull up those scriptures. It says, "An immunity from God and his apostle to those with whom ye are a league, among the polytheist Arabs, those who join gods with God. And when the sacred months are past, kill those who join other gods with God, wherever ye shall find them, and seize them, besiege them, and lay wait for them with every kind of ambush. But if they shall convert and observe prayer and pay the obligatory alms, then let them go their way, for God is gracious, merciful." Then the scripture about make war on them. And the Quran does say, "So make war on them. By your hands will God chastise them and will put them to shame and will give you victory over them and will heal the bosoms of a people who believe." So the article that Mr. Hunt wrote makes it sound like anyone not a Muslim is to be killed. But the verses that he quoted and we just read refer to polytheist Arabs, Arabs who worship many gods, went on to say to make war against them. So are we clear about what the Quran says about Jews and Christians today? Not exactly. Well, neither am I. The conclusion that I've come to from reading the book on Islam, and I've read just about the whole thing, and I've read a lot of from the Quran regarding Jews and Christians. The conclusions that I've come up to is that there are people who practice Islam who will say that Islam teaches so-and-so. Then there are other people who will say, no, Islam doesn't teach that. Islam teaches this and that. And then there are still others who will disagree and says, no, Islam teaches X, Y, and Z. But there's another major world religion that I can say the same thing about it. Perhaps you've heard about it. It's called Christianity. Because there are a myriad of beliefs that people say they get from the Bible. So I'm not surprised that there are Muslims like those in ISIS and Al-Qaeda who believe that the Quran says to kill non-Muslims, all non-Muslims. While other Muslims will say, no, the Quran does not say that. But, and this is the important part, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where Israel is concerned, because the Arab people would be against Israel talking about the nation Israel plus the descendants of Israel today, Arab people would still be against them if there had never been a prophet Muhammad and the Quran. The conflict between Arabs and Jews was prophesied about 4,000 years ago, or I should say Arabs and Israel. It predates Islam by about 2,500 years. And the conflict was prophesied in this book, the Bible. And before we look at another piece of the conflict in the Middle East, I'd like to look at the Arabic word jihad. I think we've all heard that word. It's a word we hear bandied quite a bit in the Muslim world. Jihad. How many times do we see on TV perhaps Arabs shooting out of guns and screaming and jumping around, saying death to America, death to Israel, as they call for a jihad against us? Well, let me read from Understanding Islam on this word, jihad. He writes, jihad in Arabic means to struggle or strive for something. It does not mean a holy war, as English dictionaries often mislabel it. So he says jihad does not mean holy war. But he also says this. He says, however, the word jihad is most often associated with the act of physically confronting evil and wrongdoing. Hence, it can be applied to the act of fighting as well. But the goal of a physical jihad is not to have a big war, gain riches, or kill people. It is to further the cause of Allah and to create justice on earth. Then, when the evil is removed or the other side wants peace, Muslims are to make peace as well. And then he quotes from the Quran below that. He says, those who fight in the cause of God and those who reject faith fight in the cause of evil. So fight against the friends of Shaitan. And Shaitan is the Arabic word for Satan. It's saying to fight against whoever's with Satan. But of course, when I read that, I thought, well, what do many Muslims and Arabs refer to as to the United States as? About the great Satan. That's what jumped to my mind there. Now, the original meaning and intent of the word jihad may not have been holy war. But how do these terrorists and Muslim extremists of the world use the word jihad? They use it as a holy war against America, against Israel. Now, do you think the Muslim extremists of this world care if they're misusing the word jihad? No. If they want the word jihad to mean holy war, then that's what it means to them. And it obviously does mean that to them. And that's how they use it. And I take it seriously when people like that call for a jihad against us. Now, it's estimated that there are about 1.9 billion Muslims in the world. And it only takes a small percentage of Muslims to believe in a jihad, a holy war against Israel, to cause problems. And I think we can see that they have. And I think we know they'll continue to do so. Now, before we look at the conflict between Arabs and Israel, when it will end, I want to take a look at a people called the Amalekites. Let's go over to 1 Samuel 15. We'll pick it up in verse 3. 1 Samuel 15, verse 3. Because the descendants of these Amalekites may have something to do with the hatred today towards the descendants of Israel. First Samuel 15, verses 1, 2, and 3. Samuel also said to Saul, the Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore, heed the voice of the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and do not spare them. But kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. Israel was to totally destroy Amalek. That's what King Saul was told. No one was to be left of the Amalekites. Why? It says because of what they did to Israel as they came out of Egypt. And as we'll see, that they fought against Egypt. They hit the stragglers and killed them as they came out of Egypt. And when you read that, some people think, well, God was very harsh in telling Saul to do that, to utterly destroy the Amalekites. Well, let's turn back to Deuteronomy 25, verse 17. Deuteronomy 25, verse 17. And we'll see that Amalek, the Amalekites, were a thorn in Israel's side. And God knew they would continue to torment Israel if they weren't dealt with. Deuteronomy 25, starting in verse 17. Remember what Amalek, and I want you to remember that phrase for a little later in the sermon. Remember what Amalek did to you as you were coming out of Egypt. They weren't to forget Amalek. How he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear when you were tired and weary, and he did not fear God, talking about Amalek. Therefore shall be, when the Lord your God has given you rest from your enemies all around in the land which the Lord your God has given you to possess as an inheritance, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. Okay, remember that. But they were not to forget Amalek. Now let's go back to 1 Samuel 15. And we'll see that Saul did not obey God in utterly destroying the Amalekites. 1 Samuel 15, verse 7. And Saul attacked the Amalekites from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is east of Egypt. He also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. So, did Saul just obey God after all? No, he didn't. Verse 9. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were unwilling to utterly destroy them. But everything despised and worthless, that they utterly destroyed. Now the word of the Lord came to Samuel, I greatly regret that I have set up Saul as king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. And it grieved Samuel, and he cried out to the Lord all night. So what did Saul have to say about disobeying God? Well, let's read it. And brethren, this is what carnal nature is like, and this is what our carnal nature can be like, brethren. 1 Samuel 15, verse 13. Then Samuel said to Saul, and Saul said to him, blessed are you, the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord. I like this sarcasm from Samuel. But Samuel said, what then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? And Saul said, they have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed. Notice the blame. It wasn't him. It was the people. And Samuel said to Saul, be quiet, and I will tell you what the Lord said to me last night. And he said to him, speak on. Let's drop down to 18. Now the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord? And Saul said to Samuel, but I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. And was he read? No, he didn't. But he still won't admit it. It's not his fault. And goes on and gone on the mission which the Lord sent me and brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people, again, it's the people's fault, took of the plunder, sheep, and oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgad. And brethren, these next two verses are verses we also need to remember. So Samuel said, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams." Verse 23, "For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry." Let's read that part again. "And stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry." Because all too often, what do we think about our stubbornness? You know, we usually think, oh, my stubbornness is righteous stubbornness. You know, it's okay for me to be stubborn, but is it? "Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king." So the story teaches us about obedience to God in all matters, big matters, small matters, doesn't matter. God expects obedience. God demands obedience, complete obedience in all matters. But what do the Amalekites have to do with the situation between Israel and the Muslim world today, if anything? Well, who was Amalek? Well, let's go back to Genesis again. Genesis 36, we'll pick it up in verse 12. Who is Amalek? And we'll see here that Amalek was a grandson of Esau. And in verse 1 and also in Genesis 25:30, Esau is called Edom. Remember that word, Edom. Esau was Jacob's Israel's brother, and of course Isaac's son. So Ishmael was also Esau's uncle. Uh-oh, more genealogies here. Genesis 36, verse 12. "Now Timnah was the concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz, Esau's son." So Ishmael's sons and Amalek were first cousins twice removed, because Esau and Ishmael's sons were first cousins, and Esau's sons were first cousins once removed to Ishmael's sons. And the 12 sons of Israel and Amalek were first cousins once removed. All right, already with the cousins once removed and twice removed. So all that means is that the Amalekites and the Israelites were related again. They were all kin to one another. They were family. And the Amalekites were right in there with the family feud. Although, since they're not descendants of Ishmael, they are not Arabs. Their descendants are from Esau or Edom. And today they are thought to be in Turkey. And some people think they are in Iran today. So do we hear any more of the Amalekites after Saul doesn't destroy them as he was told? Well, yes, we do. Again, let's go back to 1 Samuel, this time 1 Samuel 28, verses 17 and 18. You know, if Samuel or Saul had obeyed God concerning the Amalekites, things could have been different for Samuel. Things definitely would have been better for or different for Israel. 1 Samuel 28, verse 1 Samuel 28, verse 17, "And the Lord has done for himself as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David. Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord nor execute his fierce wrath upon Amalek, therefore the Lord has done this thing to you this day." So now David had to deal with the Amalekites, but the Amalekites were never destroyed. Let's go over to 2 Samuel 1, starting in verse 1. 2 Samuel 1, we'll read verses 1 through 10. "2 Samuel 1, verse 1, now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had stayed 2 days in Ziklag. On the third day, behold, it happened that a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. So it was, when he came to David, that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. And David said to him, 'Where have you come from?' So he said to him, 'I have escaped from the camp of Israel.' And David said to him, 'How did the matter go? Please tell me.' And he answered, 'The people have fled from the battle. Many of the people are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also.' So David said to the young man who told him, 'How do you know that Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead?' Then the young man who told him said, as I happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa, there was Saul leaning on his spear, and indeed the chariots and horsemen followed hard after him. Now when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me, and I answered, here I am. So he said to me, who are you? So I answered him, I am an Amalekite. He said to me again, please stand over and kill me, for anguish has come upon me, but my life still remains in me. So I stood over him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet that was on his arm, and I brought them here to my Lord. Because of the Amalekites, Saul was removed as king over Israel. And instead of Saul killing the Amalekites, as he was told to do, here we're told that Amalekite killed Saul. So what happened to the Amalekites? Let's turn over to 1 Chronicles 4, verse 42 and 43. 1 Chronicles 4, verse 42 and 43. Amalek's descendants continued in their fight against Israel's descendants. 1 Chronicles 4, verse 30 or 42. Now some of them, 500 men of the sons of Simeon, went to Mount Seir, having as their captains Pelatiah, Neariah, Raphaiah, and Uzziel, the sons of Ishi, and they defeated the rest of the Amalekites who had escaped. They have dwelt here to this day. They have dwelt there or lived there to this day, and they are still in the Mediterranean area. Perhaps in Turkey, and most likely, yes, they are Muslims. Let's look at Psalm 83, verse 3. Psalm 83, verses 3 through 7. Let me ask you this. Today, is there just one Muslim or Arab country or nation that's involved in the case or the fight against Israel? No. Most of the Muslim world is against Israel. I was trying to think of one Muslim country that is pro-Israel. And there may be one, but I couldn't think of one off the top of my head. Seems for the Arab countries, about the only thing that unites them is their hatred of Israel. It also includes Egypt and Jordan, who, although they have signed peace treaties with Israel, they both support the Palestinians over Israel. Psalm 83, verse 3. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation. That the name of Israel may be remembered no more. For they have consulted together with one consent. They form a confederacy against you. The tents of Edom, which remember is Esau, and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagrites, Gebal, Ammon and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre. This spring holiday season, we're having a trip. The church is sponsoring a trip to Israel, to the Holy Land. And over the years, the church has done that. It's probably 8-10 years or so before we had that, since we had that before. And I can remember listening to a sermon, and I want to say it was by Dave Register. It may have been Dave Johnson, but I'm pretty sure it was Dave Register. I'll have to ask him when I see him. But in the sermon, he was talking about the trip to Israel that they made. And he was talking about they're on the tour bus, and as they drove, if there was an Israeli soldier walking on the side, the bus driver would stop the bus and give the Israeli soldier a ride. And when the Israeli soldier would come on the bus, he would say something in Hebrew to the bus driver, and the bus driver would repeat the same thing back to him. And this happened several times. To take the soldier down the road, and there'd be another one. He'd pick him up, and the Israeli soldier would say something in Hebrew, and the bus driver would repeat it. And like I say, it happened, several times. Of course, our tour group didn't understand Hebrew, so when Mr. Register got an opportunity, he asked the bus driver, what is it that the soldier's saying to you that you're repeating back to him? And the bus driver replied, he's saying to me, Remember Amalek. Remember Amalek. So the modern state of Israel has learned not to forget. They also have an expression about the Holocaust. They'll say, never again. And I believe the Israelis when they say those things. We didn't have time to go to the book of Esther. But if you get a chance, some of you may remember the story of Haman, the king's high official who had an edict passed to have all the Jews killed. They kind of tricked the king into doing that. Well, it says that Haman, in the book of Esther, was an Agagite. Remember King Agag of the Amalekites? So Jewish tradition says that Haman was descended from the Amalekites. In fact, Josephus, in his Iniquity of the Jews, did say that Haman is an Amalekite. Of course, Haman wanted to kill all the Jews. So who are the Amalekites today? Only God knows exactly, but the descendants are there somewhere in the Mediterranean area. Perhaps they are Turkish Muslims. Perhaps they are, some of them, Iranian Muslims. But they are still in the fight against Israel. Now, will the Amalekites be directly involved in end-time prophecies described in Revelation, Matthew 24, Daniel, and other books of the Bible? Again, only God knows. But we do know that the descendants are still around and they're still involved in the family feud. However, we do know when this family feud will end. Let's go over to Matthew 24. We just mentioned it. Matthew 24. Let's review when it will end. Matthew 24, verse 13. Matthew 24, verse 13, but he who endures to the end shall be saved, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, whoever reads this, let him understand. Of course, this has not happened yet. Drop down to verse 21. But then there will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. I think we know that what happened on 9/11 is nothing compared to what the tribulation is going to be like. 9/11 is just a tiny foretaste, an extremely tiny foretaste. Verse 29 of Matthew 24, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven and then will all the tribes in the earth will mourn and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. And of course, this is the return of Jesus Christ, and this will be the beginning of the end of the family feud. You know, many people just still can't believe what happened on 9/11, or in Paris, or in San Bernardino. And what happened on those days is terrible. It was horrible. But we must remember that the time is coming when the whole world will be devastated. Horrible won't even begin to describe what's going to happen to this world before Christ returns to put an end to it. And before Satan is through, before Satan is stopped, the whole world is just going to be one big 9/11. Let's turn back to Revelation. Revelation 11, verse 3. This concerns the death of the two witnesses. Let's see Satan's influence combined with human carnal nature. Because Satan and carnal nature they're working together today in this world. Revelation 11, verse 3. And I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth. Verse 7, when they finish their testimony, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit will make war against them, overcome them, and kill them. And their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. Then those from the peoples, tribes, tongues, and nations will see their dead bodies 3.5 days and will not allow their dead bodies to be put in graves. And those who dwell on the earth will rejoice over them, make merry, and send gifts to one another, because these two prophets tormented those who dwell on the earth. Ever since the events of 9/11, you know what I picture when I read verse 10? I remember that TV video of Palestinians in the West Bank or Gaza Strip celebrating over 9/11. You know, Donald Trump says it was over in Jersey City, he saw it, but no one's come up with that. But I do remember that it did happen it was either the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. And they were just dancing and shouting and cheering in the streets. They were rejoicing and making merry because thousands of Americans were killed by those vicious attacks on 9/11. That's how much the descendants of Ishmael hate Israel. That's how much they hate America. Now, the Arab people don't hate the Jews, don't hate America, don't hate Israel because they're Muslims and the others are Christians and Jews. No. The Arabs could be Coptic Christians, and some are. The Arabs could be Orthodox Christians, and some are. They could be Catholic, Buddhist, Hindu, Baptist, Pentecostal, or they all can convert to Judaism. It wouldn't matter. Because the Arabs, descendants of Ishmael, among others, would still hate Israel. And it all goes back to Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael. Islam is not the root cause of the problem, but it adds to it. And the Arab peoples will continue to make war against Israel, and Satan will continue to spur it all on. And Satan will use various means to get what he wants. We have to be aware that sometimes Satan's ways on the surface sound good, but if Satan is behind it, be assured, its end is nothing but evil. This was in the news recently. Saudi Arabia announced an Islamic confederation of 34 Arab and Muslim countries, and their mission in coming together is to fight Islamic terrorism. And apparently it was in response to criticism by the United States and Western Europe that the Muslim countries are not doing enough to fight Islamic terrorism, fighting terrorist groups such as ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And after the announcement, there was some positive responses from the West, so apparently they're going to support this Islamic confederation to help them achieve their goal. Well, I got to thinking, now, if this Islamic confederation is successful in eliminating ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups, what will it do then? Will it disband? Or could it morph into something else? Could it grow, but in a different direction? Add to their numbers, but this time not working with the West, but perhaps working against the West. And if something like that were to happen, we don't know if it would, could we see the start of some of the Bible prophecies of the end time being fulfilled by their forming an even more vast Islamic confederation? Again, only God knows. Let's turn to Revelation 19. Verse 11, as we begin to close. Revelation 19, verse 11. The descendants of Ishmael, the descendants of Amalek want war, and they'll get what they want. The time is coming when they'll wish that they never got what they wanted, because unfortunately they leave Jesus Christ out of all this that they want. Revelation 19, starting in verse 11. I love reading these scriptures, especially on the Feast of Trumpets. I always try to fit it in on the Feast of Trumpets. Now, I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. These Islamic terrorists will get what they want. They want a holy war, they'll get a holy war, but it will be with the true Holy One. Jesus Christ is going to bring them the war that they want. In verse 12, his eyes were like a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. He had a name written that no one knew except himself. He was clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses. Now out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, and with it he should strike the nations, and he himself will rule them with a rod of iron. He himself treads the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. And he has on his robe and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lords of Lords. And Jesus Christ will put an end to all this. Jesus Christ will put an end to the war on terrorism. And when Christ returns, this war will be the war to end all wars. Let's go over to the book of Micah in the Old Testament for a final scripture. Micah 4, verse 1. It's in the Minor Prophets, right after Jonah and before Nahum. Brethren, the time is coming when the Osama bin Ladens of this world, and there are many, the time is coming when they will learn to live by these scriptures. Micah 4, verse 1. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and peoples shall flow to it. Many nations shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion the law shall go forth, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between many peoples and rebuke strong nations afar off. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. And I love that last verse. Neither shall they learn war anymore. Now that is something that people, all people, should be dancing and cheering and shouting for joy in the streets about. That's something to celebrate over. When the whole world learns God's way of life, when the whole world walks in his path, then and only then will there be no more 9/11s. Then and only then there will be no more vicious attacks like those in Paris and California. Then and only then will the war on terrorism end. And as the last part of verse 5 says, we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. Not to the God of Islam, brethren, but the true God. For then there will be no more terrorists, no more hatred, no more family feud. And that time is coming, brethren. And let's all make sure that we are watching and making ourselves ready. And let's make sure we follow the true God in the true book. And let's make sure we also stay tuned. For I think, as we all know, there's a lot more that has to happen. Good Sabbath, brethren.